Our next talk will be by Tom Talpe from Microsoft, and he will be speaking of SMB3 application workload performance. We're going more to the application.
Hi, could you excuse me while I just make one technical check here? When I'm in presentation mode, I'm not always certain I can zoom. Okay. I zoomed. Good. All right. Well, you'll see why I'm checking that in a minute. I hope I don't cause too much of an eye chart. Hi again. I'm Tom Talpe, architect in the Windows File Server team. This is my fourth Samba XP, and I still love it. It's a lot of fun to come here. So this time around, I'm going to channel my colleague Dan Lovinger, who published a very interesting paper that's on the web. I'll show you the URL at the end. You can go read it. But we've been, now that we've shipped SMB3, which we did in Server 2012, we've been doing a lot of thinking about what are the key workloads, where do we need to focus our efforts for performance, for features, for future features, for basically all kinds of things that require measuring what we've shipped, right? And so Dan is quite the expert in evaluating components and developing metrics for measuring those components and for actually analyzing the results that he got. And he came up with some very interesting things that I want to talk about today. There's a little bit about futures in here too, which I hope you'll find interesting. So the outline of the talk is first to talk a little bit about the application workloads. Why do we see SMB3 being key for certain types of workloads, and where do we focus our effort workload-wise? It's both the application and the workload, right? The application has one behavior, and then the storage workload is another one. Second, the methodology that we use to identify these things. And third, the results, what we actually measured and how we analyzed them. And finally, the little look ahead at work in progress. Goals. Goals of a whole lot of things are kind of sitting in here. The first is, the foremost thing, is to demonstrate that SMB3 is a valid best choice for application workloads. Right? Not necessarily every application, but for the applications that we focus on, for the applications that we designed SMB3 for, we certainly want it to be the best choice for those areas. Right? We strongly believe in file sharing, right? Sharing of files, right? Not of devices, not of single, locally attached, non-shared things. And we believe that SMB3 takes the feature set of the protocols and the performance profile of that thing to enterprise readiness. Second, evaluate the potential of new server hardware with SMB3. We're doing a number of things with Windows Server 2012. Our cluster-in-a-box configuration was talked about quite a bit over the past year, and clustered configurations of Windows Server that serve files. The world is changing, right? A lot of changes are happening in platforms. Storage platforms are changing, the type of storage, the storage interconnect, all kinds of things are changing. So we want ways to be able to measure these new platforms that come along, or to, given a random new platform that comes along, we can say, what does it do? What should we expect it to do? We want to continue to evaluate the performance of RDMA-capable fabrics. The fabrics are doing the same thing. Currently, InfiniBand is the bandwidth leader at about 54 gigabits. It's moving to 100 gigabits. That's its basic next step. Ethernet is going through the 10 to 40 gigabit transition right now. It's starting to be deployed at 40 gigabits. And so, how are these fabrics behaving as they go faster? How does the latency change? How do the fabrics change? How do the protocols change? Things like that. What other requirements are there of these fabrics? Do I need to change my infrastructure, go to a data center bridging infrastructure, for instance, and what are the best practices for that? Fourth goal, measure the comparison to local storage. That kind of feeds back to the first one, right? Everybody will say, well, I'll just plug a disk into this thing, and I'll just use that disk, and that's the fastest possible. we're beginning to disprove that with SMB, right? So we want to measure that comparison. We want to say, an SMB deployment will give you this. A local storage deployment will give you this. Other deployments will give you this. So comparison. Finally, demonstrate that it's reasonable to consider remotely deployed storage for highly scaled server environments. That's the same thing as the first one, but emphasis on scaling, right? Scaling, scaling, scaling. So file sharing is good for scaling, and networks are good for scaling. So how far can we go? And chart a future performance course and metrics to use. We want to open a discussion. You know, how do you measure file storage? Or at least at this micro level, how do you measure it? There are other higher level things going on. Spec, for instance, is going through a new rev of Spec SFS and things like that. But we're talking about the low level performance in a very fundamental way. In the Windows world, there are two key application workloads for SMB3, Hyper-V and SQL. In the presentations when we released Windows Server 2012, these were the two enterprise apps that had certified operation and actually recommended operation over SMB3 with Windows Server. And so they remain our key single application workloads. Of course, general file sharing workloads are still important. General file sharing workloads, unfortunately, don't translate to a single workload, right? They classify into certain types of workloads. Also, general file sharing is not always performance sensitive or availability sensitive, right? It's just plain old file sharing kind of thing. But Hyper-V and SQL bring some very specific requirements for availability and performance to the table. And so they are key workloads because they must be met or you don't get certified. So look at these two apps and think, you know, what happens at the storage layer? Well, there are basically two or possibly three different workloads that they emit in spades and the ones that really matter. They emit lots of other operations and they matter too, but these are the ones that, you know, you do day in, day out, every second of every day. The first is 8K random. Random is done by Hyper-V and by SQL for their bread and butter work, either VHD reads and writes, and it's 8K because that's the NTFS cluster size, or it's the SQL table page size, right? And so they're reading primarily and writing somewhat these pages, 8K pages. Pure read is a very interesting workload because it's very easy to focus on. There's one direction of the data and one type of operation. Plus a read-write mix. The read-write mix is typically asymmetrical, more reads than writes, 60-40, 66-33, rarely 50-50, but it can happen. The second major workload is 512K sequential, large sequential. And we use 512K as a rule of thumb. It can vary around this number somewhat, but it's way bigger than 8K is the bottom line. And you'll see this a lot for things like backup, for disk migration, the copy of bulk data, and decision support in data mining from a SQL server. They do that whenever they're reading unstructured table space to perform data mining operations. It's just a huge sequential read of a gigantic file, a gigantic database table space file, and it'll chew on it. Interestingly, decision support in data mining are very CPU overhead sensitive. Right? You want to give as much CPU as possible to the data mining application. You want to spend as little CPU as possible reading the data. That's not the interesting part. For a transactional database, reading and writing reliably is very important. For data mining, you just want to spool this stuff into memory as quickly as possible and process it, get it the heck out, get the answer the heck out. So they're almost always pure read. There's some big writes, obviously. A backup may write to another disk, et cetera. But pure read is what you're interested in because that's what the application actually issues. And you know, like I say, it wanders around that number. 512K, it can be bigger than that. SMB actually supports bigger than that. It can also be 64K. 64K is interesting at some of the edges of these workloads. So the paper is motivated by a very interesting new platform that arrived recently. EchoStreams is kind of a boutique builder in the Silicon Valley. And they have a device called the FlashSAN2. It's spelled kind of funny. but that's how they spell it. It's an appliance that they sort of custom build. It's really interesting. I should put a picture up here. It's like 2 U's high. It's got 48 SAS drives in it that you usually make into SSDs. We do. And it takes a whole ton of PCI cards inside for RAID controllers and network devices. And it has a reasonably beefy server motherboard in it. So what we deployed for our test is actually not quite what the device is capable of. It was an early device. It was the first generation device, and it wasn't fully certified. So it had only 5 of these LSI PCI Express Gen 3 PCI SAS HBAs. It could have taken 6. But each SAS HBA would take 8 Intel 520s. We configured them with 520 model SSDs. And we then created groups of 5 mirrored 4-column, 2-copy storage spaces. Okay, so basically we had high performance storage spaces. And each space we exposed as an SMB share. 2 CPUs. These were only 2 gigahertz. The latest version, which came out a couple months ago, is available with a clock upticked, 2.40. And it had just 32 gigs of DRAM. We were doing uncached workloads on the server, so DRAM really didn't matter. The client in our test that I'm about to talk about was a generic white box, perfectly ordinary motherboard, into which we inserted a matching 3 Mellanox ConnectX FDR HCAs. They're connected back to back, as you can see in that picture, between the two boxes. The client and server have 3 sort of, you know, triple-barreled shotgun connected to one another. And the client had a ton of memory. We kind of used that memory. I guess they were just configured that way for caching tests. So that was our setup. There's much more detail in the paper that I'll show you later. Methodology. The client workload generator, we always use Microsoft's SQL.io. SQL.io is a database storage emulator. It's basically able to create synthetic workloads to mirror the behavior of Microsoft SQL Server. It can do small I/O, large I/O, random, read, write, you name it. And it can also do an interesting thing. It can affinitize itself. When it starts up its threads, these threads can request affinity. And so they can run on specific CPU cores or sockets. And that's exactly what we did when we ran this. We would run, because it's a two-socket system, NUMA two-socket system, we would run 2 instances of SQL.io, each one affinitized to 1 socket. We did this for a couple of reasons. That's the way the applications run, right? Hyper-V affinitizes a VM to a core or a small set of cores and uses a single socket when it does that. SQL Server absolutely does that. SQL Server puts its page cleaners on specific cores and tasks them. So they perform all the I/O in one place. And so these are NUMA-aware applications that know very, very well how important it is to keep NUMA affinity. And so we believe that to emulate or to evaluate the performance of storage system at C means to do that exact same thing. On the server side, we created 200 gigabyte files as virtual drive on each virtual drive. And then the client instances would split their load per socket they were running on, right? So the share would have 2 files on it, and you know, one client SQL.io would access one of the files, and the other one the other file. So there was, if you will, not a hardware affinity, a core affinity on the server, but there was a file affinity that avoided locking contention. And once again, that matches the behavior of the applications. The applications will typically isolate their I/O so that they don't collide with their peers. They want all their I/Os to flow directly to the storage. So our goal, as I said, was to emulate the typical NUMA-aware modern application. Hyper-V and SQL Server both do this. And I just want to make one little note about units. You have to be real careful when benchmarking to be clear about your units. And a lot of people are sloppy about this. We hope to just pound this home. A kilobyte, KB, is decimal by convention in the world, okay? I know the storage industry and the computing industry often makes it binary or hexadecimal, but it's really not. And ISO, but the IEC standards have a new method for describing hexadecimal to the 10th, to the 20th, that kind of thing. Kibibytes, mebibytes, and gigibytes, I think they are. In any event, GIB. So we will try to carefully use those when we quote numbers. And actually, in most of what I have, we don't. These may not play in too much, but in the paper, you'll see that they're pretty important to keep track. It makes a big difference when you get up to gigas, and it makes an enormous difference at teras. I mean, you're off by like 7-8%, you know, maybe 10%. You can do a lot of lying with a error, you know, margin that wide. So we have two main metrics that we're going to mention. The first metric is overhead, CPU overhead. And we do that at Microsoft and the SMB team as cycles per byte. A lot of people do this. It's a fairly standard measure of CPU bandwidth efficiency. It's used in the networking and storage worlds quite a bit. The percent privileged CPU utilization is measured. And then the bandwidth being currently seen in bytes is measured. And then the other two numbers are effectively constants. The core clock and the number of cores are known for the hardware that it's running on. There are a couple of caveats, though. We measure privileged CPU, and we do that because, you know, this is an ordinary Windows Server 2012 system. We don't want to charge ordinary system overhead to the I/O. Right, we want to make sure that we keep that separate. Using privileged is a quick way to do that. And the other thing we want to avoid is the load generator itself. Load generator is the application, and we don't want to charge the application for the application's cost, right? We only want to say what overhead the system added. So we use privileged instead of total CPU utilization. And the second thing that's important is the core clock. On modern systems, it is not a constant. In fact, it is definitely not a constant. It ranges over a very wide range. And so you have to do something to treat it as a constant in your calculation, or you can't make a repeatable, accurate measurement. So we do those five things. We disable hyperthreading. We go into the BIOS and turn that off. Hyperthreading actually messes up the number of cores, but it also messes up the effective throughput of the system, because it's totally different. You get a totally different throughput depending on what your instruction mix is. Right, whether it needs X register and there isn't another copy of that register, all of a sudden that instruction doesn't execute. So it's effectively a clock issue, I argue. Turbo Boost and Speed Step, definitely turn those off. They're great for improving performance, right? Turbo Boost to raise the clock, Speed Step to lower and raise the clock. But you don't want the clock to change, so we turn them off. This is all BIOS stuff. Virtualization disabled, the virtual extensions pretty much get in the way. We don't want them there. BIOS deep C states disabled. You really have to disable them. You have to turn off the damn C states. These BIOSes all have very different behavior, and the behavior is very unpredictable. And just allowing these systems to doze really messes up your latency of recovery. So we just disable them. It burns power, I know, but we're only doing this for our test to be able to compute a specific value. You would not do this in the real world. And finally, the Windows power plan, turning it to max performance disables all the Windows contribution to this mess. So basically, once you turn all these off, we get reasonably repeatable numbers. So re-enabling can definitely improve performance. So we argue that our results are therefore conservative, right? We're reducing all those numbers on the numerator, right? Second metric, latency, very important. There are two client client visible components of latency. The first is the wire time, the bit transmission time. And you can see that on the left-hand arrow. It's the time from the moment the client issues a request to the time the server actually sees it, in effect. It's the transmit time, when no work is being done. It's just moving across the network. And it includes a very interesting thing, that the request being queued on and off the adapter. There's some queues in software as well as adapter queues. It's really hard to measure those, but some of the queues at the top of that stack can be seen in Windows Perfmon as stalls. There are some credit stalls in the SMB layer. There are some RDMA credit stalls down in the SMB direct layer. Things like that can delay the transmission of a packet unknown to the app. On the server, the latency is measured in the two major processing steps, the NTFS processing time, assuming that the server doesn't take much time to unmarshal the request, basically. But how long does it take the file system to perform the I/O? And what is the actual time for the storage for the SSD? These are all uncached workloads, so they're going to flow directly to the hardware. And when measuring latency, it's important because you get a pretty wide distribution of latency. Sometimes you get some really far outliers. And you don't want to count the outliers. You really want to count the working part of the workload. So we use a 90th percentile approach. We measure the cumulative latency. We basically add up all the latencies seen until we reach the 90th percentile of the maximum latency seen. We, in effect, clip the tail off on the right side of the latencies. And this is a fairly standard statistical approach for evaluating the latencies, but it takes into account the worst case. We might take the 50 percentile, right? But that would ignore all the bad stuff that happens above that. So we chose the 90th percentile. And once again, I mentioned this as conservative, but we believe the most accurate. And we always measure individual I/O latencies using the Windows Performance Analyzer. And we take at least 1 million samples or 1 minute of traffic with a warm-up before we measure anything. And I just want to note that you expect latencies to go up for certain things, but if it's unexpected, it can indicate a bottleneck being reached, and I'll show you a few examples. Okay, this is our first result. To draw a baseline, we ran a single I/O, single-threaded, single-issue I/O, to a single share, just to measure what would be seen. What would we consider consistent good performance from the basic wire and the basic client and server? Volker. SQL I/O was generating the I/O, and SQL I/O. SQL I/O does that. SQL I/O is a synthetic load generator. It issues I/Os asynchronously from a certain number of threads with a certain number of outstanding I/Os. So and when you set it to one and one,
don't have SQL
server. No. Yeah.
But honestly, it's pretty similar to iometer. In this case, we're just generating synchronous 1K,
UK. Yeah, in fact, you could, maybe I should mention this, you could run iometer here. The reason we choose SQL I/O is that it's very tightly integrated with Windows. That affinitization option, for instance, is a very important thing that we feel we need to control to emulate the application well. And so if we used iometer, you know, we would have to wrap a lot around it to really get there. Iometer is really cool because it has a really nice GUI. You know, it's a really handy thing to run if you want to see it as a quick test. But we really want to zero right in. We want to take these measurements not in SQL I/O. SQL I/O isn't actually measuring it here. It's just generating a bunch of load. We use Windows Performance Analyzer to measure these latencies. And we capture all these samples, and then we actually analyze the resulting sample set to figure out what happened. We seek consistent good performance. I'm probably going to go over here and try laser pointer mode. This is difficult. Yeah, I know, but then I have to like step down. Do we have a laser pointer? That would be helpful.
Just don't point it at your eyes.
Yeah, I got a bunch of things to point at in these three slides. So, basically, we ran runs with 1 kilobyte, 8 kilobytes, kibibytes, I should be saying more accurately, 64 and 512. All right. So one is actually not interesting. Very few workloads run 1 kilobyte, but it's interesting because it's a single packet on the wire, and it's a nice tiny gram, right? You can basically take it down to what you consider 1 byte and measure how low can you go, all right? And so for each one, we measured the 90th percentile latency of a read and a write. We measured the client's latency, the server's latency, and the wire latency, all right? And so you can see that these are all very well behaved, that the latencies increase roughly by the transmission time, that the server and client latencies are all nice and even, that they're basically proportional to the amount of data being transmitted in each packet. And you can see right here, for instance, these things are bone flat, right? The latencies are basically tracking each I/O size perfectly flat. That's a really nice result, right? So that tells us that we have at least a good measure of the latencies that we see in our test. And there are a couple of interesting things, too. Server latency is collected around a very tight spike right in the middle. And so, you know, it's hitting a disk to satisfy this I/O. You can basically draw the conclusion that this is all being satisfied by the SSD, that this latency is effectively showing you the physical latency of that storage, the longest latency thing in the system. And there's a little bit of, you know, funny tale out here, but basically SSDs are pretty funny about this too, by the way, we're seeing a good picture of server latency. And another interesting picture is this cumulative latency of client and server. Remember I talked about that 90th percentile, which is right, you know, here, just below 100. It basically adds up the latencies of all the operations seen as they progress. And the server latency and client latency are nearly identical. So that shows us that everything is basically well-tuned, that we're seeing these latencies smoothly through the system. We're not seeing, you know, a glitchy latency on one side and a glitchy latency on the other side canceling each other out. We're seeing a nice smooth behavior between the two. So we have reasonable confidence in our numbers once we see this kind of thing. It took quite a while to get this to look so good, by the way. We were playing with a whole lot of issues in mostly the platform and the load generator before we could get nice, repeatable, solid results like this. Ira. That's because the way RDMA works. In 1K results, we use a send-receive paradigm to transmit the data, which requires a data copy within both client and server, actually at least one data copy. Whereas with 8K, anything from 4K and up, we shift to RDMA mode, okay? And so the RDMA, actually, this is showing quite an advantage. We go through this kind of measurement when we choose the threshold at which we shift from send-receive to RDMA mode. Currently, we do it at about 4K bytes, at exactly 4K bytes. One page. The second, small I/O scaling, okay? So when you start scaling, you start to issue more I/O. You start to run multiple threads, okay? So this is actually number of threads times number of IOs outstanding. So this gets to what SQL I/O can emulate. Basically, SQL I/O is told to run some, it's starting to fade after I push the little button. Maybe I'll just push the button harder, I don't know. Number of threads is, SQL I/O is multi-threaded, and as I said, it affinitizes itself in our test to both sockets on the client. And then once it's multi-threaded, it uses an asynchronous I/O paradigm. So each thread issues some number of IOs and attempts to keep them in flight. As one completes, it'll issue another one. So it always attempts to keep N in flight. So in these tests, N is 20, and the number of threads is varied from 1 to 16. Okay, and as it runs, we start to measure things. We measure IOPS seen, the 90th percentile of latency, the overhead in cycles per byte, and the raw percentage of CPU on both client and server. And the reason we show both is because at the high end, a very interesting thing happens. The server runs out of CPU. And so that's a very interesting thing that we just learned about the server. How many ops can the server maintain? Now, in the case of this flash SAN, it had a relatively low server CPU clock, 2 gigahertz. The current model has 2.4 and an extra PCI slot, and the current model can do quite a bit more here. The current model, I believe, still doesn't saturate at this workload, which is a pretty hefty workload, by the way, because I'll point out that it's running nearly 500,000 IOPS, okay, of real storage IOPS. And it is not bothering the client much at all. Even at the highest throughput, there's only half or so of the client's CPU performing this I/O rate. And at a lower throughput, something much more reasonable, the client is idling along, right? Barely using one core, right? If there are 16 cores on the client, that's a pretty nice number. No. We use only the privileged, as I said before, the privileged CPU. So this is the kernel part. This is client cycles per byte. We actually don't much care about server cycles per byte because the server's a server. It's paid to do that, right? And so, and there's only one of them. You can scale it up. But the client is an application, right? We want no CPU on the client to drive this I/O. We want to give all the CPU to the application. That means we can run more clients, more Hyper-V instances, more whatever, right? And so client cycles per byte is critical, absolutely critical. We want that number to be as low as possible. IOPS, very, very high. Server. Yeah, yeah. Well, so obviously, I'm not saying we don't care about server CPU. We do. And this same architecture, you know, the RDMA architecture in particular, benefits the server as well as the client. But the payoff is very different on the server. And it's okay for the server to consume more CPU if it pays back in performance. On the client, the equation's a little different. CPU is more precious on the client than it is on the server. But this is interesting, though, that the server ran out of CPU, we argue. And it's doing it primarily because of all the other work the server has to do. The file system has been moved to the server, right? The client doesn't have a file system at this point. It just has an SMB client. And so all that NTFS and all that storage activity is happening off box. You can think of the server as a coprocessor in this regard to the client. So that's where the overhead moved. Volker, did you?
Yeah.
True. True. Although I know of no ARM boxes that can do RDMA yet, but yeah, maybe RDMA can help them. I don't deny that it's very desirable. And the server would run out of gas, I don't know, around here with TCP, I'll bet. Yeah. At least a couple of cores would heat up to the point that it made no progress. You know, you might get 60% CPU utilization, but two of the cores would just be 100%. It couldn't accept any more packets at that point. So I guess another thing to note is that we got to 100%. We have a fully utilized server here. Every core is hot.
With a single client.
With a single client, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Single client with 16 threads.
Yeah, well, in this case, yeah, 16 threads and 320 IOs total outstanding. And so that saturation, you know, that you see right here, it can be clearly seen in the latency curve, right? The latency curve is going along linearly until all of a sudden it goes whoops and starts heading north, right? And so it basically happened between 84.5 and 99.9. Somewhere in between 8 and 16 threads, we used up the whole server. And so latency showed us that without even looking at the data in tabular format. And you can see the same thing over here. You can see a beautifully flat latency until the very end when saturation kicks in. And you notice that it only kicks in for the large I/O workload when a lot of data is flowing through the server. For smaller I/O, it's still flat. So the server's still scaling at that point. Result three, 60-40 mix. This is, I considered calling this 2A. The interesting thing about 60-40 is that it's nearly the same as pure read. The I/O rates are a little bit lower in a couple of cases. The client CPU is in roughly the same ballpark. The latency goes along just fine until the server saturates, which is, it's not shown in this table, but it saturates at nearly the same point. It's just very nice that a real-world read-write workload behaves largely the same as a pure read workload. One of the reasons that it's similar to read is that this load is not bandwidth limited. In none of these cases, if you multiply IOPS times 8K, none of these cases actually saturates the wire. They're all running out of either IOP capability in the adapter or IOP capability in the storage array, or some of the hardware along the way can't handle that many IOPS. Not the CPU and not the upper layer protocol. So if it were bandwidth limited, then actually 60-40 can start to grow because you're pushing data in both directions. In read, it's purely coming back to the client, right? It's a one-sided bandwidth curve. But if you took out 40% of those reads and replaced them with 40% of traffic on the other side of the wire, all of a sudden you wouldn't be bandwidth limited anymore and the operation rate would rise. And so we see this a lot on our Ethernet adapters where we can get full bandwidth in both directions. And it's so cool. You do a 50-50 read-write mix and the wire lights up in both directions. You don't often see that at 130 megabytes per second on a 10 gig link. You don't see that too often with storage. Large I/O. So this was another interesting one. And there's a lot to look at here. And I'm not going to waste all the rest of my talk time by going over too much of it. But there's a couple of really interesting things here. The first and most interesting is full bandwidth, 3 × 5.5 gigabytes per second, 16.4 gigabytes per second on this server. The server was basically idling, nowhere near 100% CPU, as was the client. He took a little more. Where'd he go? Actually, that's client CPU. Well, trust me, the server wasn't busy. Not shown. A few other things. The latencies are pretty good for 64, but show a really interesting curve for 512. My colleague Jim was challenging me on this earlier, and I'm not sure I can totally explain why it falls off. I can't explain why it rises so sharply. That is because the wire becomes congested. We start to use 100% of the wire, right? So the packets back up. They can't be sent because the wire is full. And so the latency will rise when that occurs. One interesting thing about the latency rising, though, is caused by SMB3 multi-channel. By default, our client and server perform multi-channel in a round-robin fashion. They attempt to maintain a constant queue length, but really, they're basically going round-robin, trying to find a queue that's eligible to accept this I/O. And so the queues are, when we're not quite full, the queues begin to back up in funny ways. They'll be available and slightly below the limit, and then all of a sudden they'll fly above the limit as the load overtaxes that queue. But a queue next to them might be lower, and so the latencies that queue sees, it might still be under the limit, will actually be better than the latency of that queue that was selected. And then once you drive enough load, then all three queues congest, and it's beyond that. And so the challenge that was asked, why doesn't this just level off? Why doesn't it just go flat? Because the latencies are what they are. You can't inject any more load into the system. I'm not sure I can totally explain that. So there is a puzzle in here. And there's a few interesting things in these curves that you can see some of that. The 64 kilobyte I/O is moving along nice and smoothly. There's a little bit of a knee, so something's going on here. But there's a much more pronounced knee in the 512K numbers. Well, I'm down to 5 minutes, so I'm going to go to my conclusion without drilling into those things too much. The conclusions that we took from our little study, which was quite a long study, was that maximum bandwidth with a really advanced, powerful server is easily achievable with SMB Direct, SMB3 and SMB Direct. 16.4 gigabytes per second, full use of all three adapters. We achieved a cycles per byte overhead of 0.31 with large I/O, just an infinitesimal number, approximately equal to local storage. I think our best local storage results on the same server were about 0.2. For 512K byte IOs. High IOPS to real storage. A lot of the time, you know, RDMA can go a lot faster than the storage, and so you wind up with fictitious storage to test your IOPS. We really, really, really wanted to prove you can do this for real. So we deployed this machine. This was the best machine we could put together for this test. And we were able to achieve 376,000 8K IOPS. You'll hear SCSI people say, I can do a million IOPS. They can do a million 512 byte IOPS. 8K, okay? At a reasonable cycles per byte, six-ish. That is a very reasonable number given an 8K workload. And finally, near constant latency profile, repeatable, dependable numbers, right? We knew the source of all the overheads in the stack. But that was Windows Server 2012. So what are we doing? We're not sitting around. We're having some fun. This is work in progress. This work was done a little while ago, and it represents a point in time of a little while ago. And it was not final and not guaranteed. Intermediate results from local-only internal optimizations. Basically, armed with the data we had from performance, we analyzed where the overhead was going within Windows, right? Where was the CPU being burned? Where can we get rid of this? You know, what problems do we have? In particular, where are our NUMA problems? This stack, all the way up to the top of the redirector and to the top of the server stack, was not usually written with this kind of performance level in mind, nor was it ready to run on NUMA machines. So we did a lot of work there. We increased request batching. That basically merges events, makes us a polled model instead of an interrupt model. Locking, the type of lock chosen in Windows, and the objects of the granularity at which objects are locked is very important. Certainly a protocol with the extensive state of SMB has a lot of locks, I think you can imagine. Cache line false sharing, just rearranging structures so that, you know, item A doesn't live on the same cache line as item B. We achieved a 36% increase on a single NIC and a 30% increase on dual NICs, and we knocked 15% of overhead off it, just with local work. No change on the wire. But as we talked about actually at the last SDC, use of remote invalidation also knocks off local work as well as improves the IOP rate. So can I just say, watch for news on this. That number is only a point in time. No, wait, I got one more thing. Oh, well, I got some references.
Are there any questions or comments on this talk? Yes, there is.
There's always the case that you can generate these fancy numbers with outrageously expensive gear. So do you have any idea what the cost of this was?
Actually, you know, I don't know what the cost of this thing was. Do you?
Yeah, it was a rhetorical question. It's about $30K.
$30K. $30,000 does that.
Any more? Yes, one more. Bye.
This is just single file, single share things, or there's the other famous benchmark, SpecSFS, with some ridiculously high numbers.
Oh yeah. SpecSFS was sort of a ordinary worker workload, right, with a lot of files, and synthetic as well. This, as I mentioned up front, this is we have two files per share and five total shares based on the five storage arrays internal to the server, right? So there were a total of 10 files that were in main use for that test.
So these 860K are not comparable. You wouldn't be able to do 860K opens.
The 860K was not to real storage. I probably should have mentioned that.
Yeah. You did.
But
you
it's
did.
There on a it's there on a page, yeah. And it says fictitious storage. We could not. I mean, the 370,000 IOPS was all we could get out of that storage device. Right, the SSDs were full at that point, so we had to go to a stubbed out storage data path to get this. And this, in fact, was a single file as a result, because there was basically no locking and no sharing whatsoever, no data handling.
Thank you.